Quick announcements, just to repeat the announcement that I made last day, which concerns a change in the lecture schedule, which you see out there. So after the exam on Tuesday, so that's a reminder that your next exam is on this coming Tuesday. After that, we're going to go on and talk about opiates. So you want to print out the lecture notes for opiates next. Then there'll be four lectures on opiates, followed by two theories of addiction, and then we'll finish up with sedative hypnotics. Okay? Just make sure you get that down so you have the right lecture notes when you come. The format for the next exam on Tuesday will be exactly the same as the format for the last exam. Any questions about the lecture schedule or the exam? So there will be a question and answer session Monday, 4 o'clock, on the terrace on the fourth floor of this building. There's a terrace there. Monday, 4 o'clock, there's an open question and answer session. Okay. So today, we're going to go on and have the last lecture on hallucinogens. And last day we had talked about the two major families of hallucinogens, the LSD family, all of which have a common structure similar to the neurotransmitter serotonin, and the phenethylamine family, the prototypical phenethylamine hallucinogen being mescaline. And all of the phenethylamine family of hallucinogens have structural similarity to catecholamine neurotransmitters. What we're going to talk about today, then, is what's known about the neurobiological mechanism of action of the hallucinogen. That is, how or by what mechanisms do these classes of compounds influence neurobiological activity, brain activity, to produce specifically their hallucinatory effects. But don't forget, those two classes, the LSD family and the phenethylamine family, have effects that are different. The phenethylamines, for example, have this stimulant component, presumably because of their structural similarity to the catecholamine transmitters, that's not shared by the LSD family, who are really pure hallucinogens without this stimulant component. So what we're talking about here isn't those kinds of effects, but specifically their hallucinogenic effects, that is, what actions in the brain mediate the hallucinogenic effects. And it's thought that both the LSD family and the phenethylamines, all of those compounds, and we talked about a whole bunch of them the other day, share a common action, at least in terms of their ability to produce hallucinogenic effects. And the reason that they're thought to share a common action comes from early pharmacological studies, primarily having to do with cross-tolerance. I told you that with LSD, for example, if it's taken in a number of days in succession, you get very rapid and large tolerance to the hallucinogenic effect. So you get less and less hallucinogenic effect with repeated administration. And you also, however, see cross-tolerance, both within drug families, so cross-tolerance between different drugs within the LSD family, but you also see cross-tolerance across the LSD and phenethylamine family. So if you repeatedly expose, or if a person repeatedly takes LSD, becomes tolerant to LSD, and they now try mescaline, they'll be cross-tolerant to mescaline. They'll also be tolerant to mescaline. So you get cross-tolerance both within and between the LSD and phenethylamine families. And the fact that there is cross-tolerance is pharmacological evidence to suggest that their hallucinogenic effects, at least, are being mediated by some sort of common neurobiological mechanism, presumably even due to some action on a common receptor site that's mediating the tolerance. Now, most of the research on the mechanisms of action of the hallucinogens has focused on serotonin systems. And that, of course, is because of their structural similarity to the neurotransmitter serotonin. And even with the phenylethylamines, who have a structure that's more similar to catecholamine transmitters, that structure is also relatively similar, and they're all monoamines. So the catecholamines and the and serotonin share this basic monoamine structure. So most of the research has focused on the possibility of serotonergic systems mediating hallucinogenic effects. And what I'm going to tell you today is sort of a story, and it's an evolving story, of that's basically a chronological story of how ideas have changed over the years about what LSD and the phenylethylamines are doing neurobiologically to mediate the hallucinogenic effects. And as you'll see, data has been collected. The data is all true, but the interpretation of those data in terms of hallucinogenic effects has changed quite dramatically over time. So it's an interesting story of how, with accumulating data, you can reach, and even though the data is all true, you can reach very, very different conclusions in terms of what these drugs are doing. So it's sort of a lesson in the progression of thinking in the field of these effects. Now, we're going to concentrate on serotonin. So we've already talked a little bit about serotonin. I've got a few extra slides thrown in here, so you won't have, like, this one's not on your handout, I don't think. This one's on your handout when we talked about monoamine neurotransmitters. But this is just to remind you about serotonergic systems, which we already talked about, just to jog memories. And you should all remember, serotonin neurons are located primarily in the raphe nuclei. So the cell bodies for these cells are down in a series of nuclei in the brainstem called raphe nuclei collectively. And they send their axons up to a whole variety of forebrain structures. So serotonin axons innervate the entire neocortex, the hippocampus, the hypothalamus, with the cell bodies located down in the midbrain. And so what you have here then is a serotonin terminal. Let's say that's in the cortex of the hippocampus. And this just outlines the synthesis of serotonin, with the precursor being tryptophan, which is obtained from dietary sources. You have a simple enzymatic step, tryptophan hydroxylase, an intermediate 5-hydroxytryptophan, and then serotonin. So serotonin is the final product. So it's a very simple synthesis. Serotonin is metabolized primarily by monoamine oxidase into its major metabolite, which is this compound 5-HEA, 5-hydroxyindoleacetic acid. Okay, you all should remember that, right? The other thing I want to emphasize here has to do with receptors. There are a lot of known serotonin receptors. Right now, there's at least 14 different serotonin receptors that have been identified and cloned. So they're called 5-HT 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then they have subtypes like 5-HT 2, 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B. So that's basically the terminology. I don't expect you to know all of these various types, but we will be talking about specific serotonin subtypes. The main thing to keep in mind is that there's a lot of them. And what serotonin does in the brain when it's released here into the synaptic cleft depends on what type of serotonin receptor the serotonin is interacting with. It's the receptor that confers specificity in the system, and there's a lot of different serotonin receptors. It's a very, very confusing field pharmacologically because there's so many receptor subtypes. Okay, so a little bit about the sort of progression of research on how serotonin is influencing, or how LSD is influencing, or thought to influence, serotonergic neurotransmission to produce hallucinatory effects. Now, the very, very first studies that were done on this back in the 50s and 60s were primarily done in peripheral tissues. And you should all remember that serotonin is very rich in a variety of peripheral tissues, like smooth muscles. And when serotonin is released onto smooth muscles, it causes smooth muscle contractions. And that's how LSD, you remember, was discovered. They were looking for different kinds of lysergic acid derivatives that could be used therapeutically as smooth muscle, to contract smooth muscles in treatment of things like postpartum hemorrhage and so on. And so peripheral tissues provided a very nice assay system in these early studies to look at the neurochemistry of LSD. Because you could take things like a guillotine piece of smooth muscle, put it in a bath, you put a little serotonin on it, and it causes smooth muscle contractions. And that kind of a bioassay was very, very common in the development of neurochemical studies and the study of neurotransmitters. So you have a little stretch of smooth muscle, wash a little serotonin on it, get a contraction. And then you could do things like what happens if you pre-treat the tissue with something like LSD to the ability of serotonin to cause smooth muscle contractions. And it was noted very early on that what LSD does is block the action of serotonin on these peripheral tissues. So if you treat the tissue with LSD, serotonin no longer causes contraction of the muscle, which suggests, of course, that what LSD is doing is antagonizing the action of serotonin. And so the very first neurochemical hypothesis of hallucinogen action was that hallucinogens were acting as serotonin receptor antagonists. And it came from these studies on peripheral tissues. That hypothesis, however, didn't last very long. Because very early on, they started to look at other kinds of compounds that were similar in structure to LSD. And one of the first of these was a compound called brome-LSD. And what it was discovered was brome-LSD acted just like LSD in peripheral tissues. So brome-LSD prevented the action of serotonin in producing these smooth muscle contractions. But when given to humans, brome-LSD is not hallucinogenic. It doesn't have any hallucinogenic properties. And so that sort of killed the hypothesis that the mechanism by which LSD produces its hallucinogenic effects is by antagonizing serotonergic actions, because here's another drug structurally very similar to LSD, does the same thing in terms of antagonizing serotonergic actions on peripheral tissues, but it's not hallucinogenic. Now, of course, one hypothesis is that what LSD is doing in peripheral tissues on a strip of guillotine ileum has very little to do with what it's doing in your brain to produce hallucinations. It must be doing something different in the brain, which then led to a whole series of studies, obviously, on the brain itself, on the actions of LSD in the brain itself, trying to figure out what it's doing on the brain itself to initiate hallucinogenic actions. And there then begun, now this is in the 60s, 70s, a whole series of studies that led to eventually what I'm calling here a presynaptic hypothesis. And what I'm going to do is just give you a couple of the kinds, just to give you a flavor of the kind of research that we've done, a couple of the kinds of experiments that are done to suggest that LSD is acting presynaptically. Now, the first kind of experiment is a neurochemical one. And at that time, 60s, 70s, the standard way to look at neuropharmacology neurochemically was give a drug, and then after the drug had been absorbed and was having its effect, say an hour or so later, take out the brain and then look at the tissue content of various transmitters. So you can assay various brain regions for how much serotonin there was, how much serotonin metabolite there was, and you can look at lots of or norepinephrine, or dopamine, or acetylcholine, whatever it was. I mean, that's a classic technique. So what you're asking here in this kind of neurochemical study is give a drug, and can you detect any kind of neurochemical change in transmitter content or transmitter metabolite content, and then try to make some inferences from those kinds of changes what the drug might be doing to the neurotransmitter. And so there were a number of studies of that type, and the findings were very consistent. If you give hallucinogens like LSD, what you find is you get an increase in serotonin content in serotonin-rich regions like the neocortex. So the an hour after LSD, the amount of serotonin that you measure in the tissue is increased, and the amount of the serotonin metabolite, hydroxyanoacetic acid, decreases. And so LSD in the brain is increasing serotonin content but decreasing serotonin metabolism. That pattern of effects on the transmitter itself and the transmitter metabolite are classically interpreted as a decrease in transmitter turnover. In this case, serotonin, what's called serotonin turnover. And the logic of that is as follows. If you give a drug and it decreases, say, the firing rate or the release of a transmitter like serotonin, then content goes up simply because less is being released, and since less is being released, you're not depleting the tissue store, and so you see content rise, presumably because release has gone down, and the metabolite's consistent with that. If you were releasing a whole bunch more transmitter, then you should have more transmitter metabolized, and the levels of metabolite should go up. But if the levels of the metabolite go down, that's suggesting that there's less transmitter being metabolized. Why is there less transmitter being metabolized? Well, because there's less being released. Okay, so this is interpreted as a decrease in activity in serotonergic neurons. Higher content because you're using out less, lower metabolism because you're using less and therefore metabolizing less. So that kind of neurochemical finding, now in brain, not in peripheral tissue, suggests that when you give a compound like LSD, what's happening is you're toning down or shutting down serotonergic systems. The second kind of experiments that started around the same time as these neurochemical studies were going on were electrophysiological experiments. And they were some of the first experiments that were done with the development of new microelectrodes that allowed you to record the activity of single neurons. So you put a very small microelectrode into the brain, and you can record from single cells, and then give a drug and ask what happens to the firing rate of specific cell populations when you give a drug. And it just so happens that the serotonergic system is very nice for studying this because all of the serotonin cell bodies are clustered together in a very tight structure, the raphe nuclei, so if you stick an electrode in there, you can record very easily from neurons that are almost exclusively serotonergic neurons. You can be pretty confident that the neurons that you're recording from are in fact serotonin neurons. And there was a fellow by the name of Akhtarjanian, who's at Yale, who then did a whole series of studies looking at a range of hallucinogenic compounds and their ability to influence the firing rate of serotonergic neurons. And what he found in all these studies is that if you gave LSD, drugs like LSD, you decrease the firing rate of serotonergic neurons. That is, LSD seemed to inhibit serotonin neurons from firing. And he got that effect whether you gave the LSD systemically, that is just injected intravenously or interperitoneally, and you also got that effect if you used a technique called ionophoresis to squirt LSD just directly onto the single cell. So you didn't have to give the LSD so that it acted everywhere in the brain. If you squirted a little LSD just onto the cell body of the serotonin cell you're recording from, it would also inhibit serotonin cell firing. And that's what's shown in these two histograms here. Or two experiments, one of them with systemic administration, the other is with ionophoretic administration directly onto the cell bodies themselves. And so the way you read these kinds of things, these are called rate event histograms, the standard way electrophysiologists often display data. So what you have here are spikes per second, that is how many times that neuron you're recording from discharges an action potential. And usually in these kind of experiments, while you're recording, you actually have the output of the amplifier hooked up to a speaker. And so whenever you go into an electrophysiology lab like that, you'll hear a speaker making sounds like pop, 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 pop. And each pop is an action potential discharge that's recorded from the speaker. And you can record these action potential discharges through some time bin. So we have time here. And so each of these time bins might be, I don't know what these are right here, but let's say each line up is a minute. And so what you record is, in a minute bin, how many times the cell fires. And so
greater than this period here before the animal gets LSD, you can see the cell is firing at approximately, I don't know, 40, 50 action potentials per second. So they're just, it's discharging away pretty quick within this time window. Then at this point, the animal's given LSD intravenously. So you just give the animal an injection of LSD and just keep recording. And what you find is after a short period of time, you get this inhibition of unit firing. And so you see the decrease in unit firing that after 10, 15 minutes or so is starting to come back. And if you wait 15, 20, 30 minutes, it'll then come back to normal. Okay? So LSD given intravenously turns off basically serotonin neurons. This just shows the same kind of data, but instead of injecting the LSD intravenously, you're just squirting a little puff of LSD, a little tiny amount, directly onto the single cell you're recording from, and that's shown here. So in this case, the LSD is applied where that little bar is. It's just applied very, very briefly. And this is just showing the application of serotonin itself, and you get a little bit of inhibition for a short period of time. And then the drug is very quickly washed away when you do this kind of stuff. And then here's an application of a certain amount of LSD, and it also produces inhibition. So this is showing two things. One, it's showing that serotonin itself, the effect of serotonin injected onto serotonin cell bodies, is to inhibit those cells. That's presumably an effect that's mediated through the action of serotonin on inhibitory autoreceptors located on the cell bodies, or the dendrites of those cells. And that LSD mimics the action of serotonin on those cells. Just like serotonin, it inhibits the firing rate of serotonin cells. And so the electrophysiology here, of course, is completely consistent with the neurochemistry. In fact, the electrophysiology suggests why you get this neurochemical profile. You give LSD, serotonin cells stop firing. They're discharging less. If they're discharging less, they're releasing less neurotransmitter. If they're releasing less neurotransmitter, you would see increased content, decreased metabolism. So the electrophysiology and the neurochemistry both suggest what's going on here is that LSD is acting presynaptically. And it's from those kinds of data, and there's a lot other examples of those kinds of data, but it's those kinds of data that led to the hypothesis at that time, that what LSD and other hallucinogens are doing is acting as agonists. Remember, in the peripheral tissue, the hypothesis was that LSD is acting as an antagonist. Now you get to completely switch 180 degrees to the hypothesis that LSD is acting as an agonist. That is, it's mimicking the action of serotonin at inhibitory autoreceptors located on serotonin cell bodies. So the idea here is, here's the serotonin cell body down in the raphe nucleus. Those serotonin cell bodies send their axons up to neocortical regions. The red things are supposed to represent serotonin receptors. So this would be a serotonin autoreceptor. This would be a postsynaptic serotonin receptor on a postsynaptic cell in the neocortex. And the idea is that where LSD is acting is at these autoreceptors located on the serotonin cell bodies. And the effect of a transmitter, serotonin itself, on an autoreceptor like that, you already know from the very first lectures in this class, is usually to mediate a negative feedback loop that results in decreased cell firing. Okay, so it makes sense. So LSD is simply acting as a serotonin agonist. It's mimicking the action of serotonin. The site that is primarily acting is at autoreceptors on the cell bodies, shutting the serotonin cells down. And then the idea was, in terms of explaining hallucinatory kinds of effects, is what that would do is result in disinhibition of cortical regions. Now, people assume that hallucinogens have to be influencing neocortical activity to produce the hallucinogenic effects, which makes sense if you think about it for a while, because what are hallucinations? It's seeing things out there or hearing things. I mean, you have very complex sensory perceptual phenomena that are created by these drugs. And it's hard to imagine that one creates de novo objects out there in the world that look for all intents and purposes, like they're real through brainstem things. I mean, those are cortical phenomena. Those are cortical level sensory perceptual phenomena. And so it's always been assumed that at some level, hallucinogens have to be influencing higher order sensory perceptual cortical kinds of systems. And but how do you get to the neocortex if what LSD is doing is acting down here in the brainstem on serotonin neurons? The idea is that these serotonin neurons project diffusely to the cortex. Serotonin is primarily an inhibitory transmitter. So when serotonin is released up here, it causes inhibition. And so the effect of LSD is to inhibit an inhibitory neuron, the serotonin neuron, which will lead to disinhibition of the cortex. And these cortical cells are now starting to fire away on their own. That's disinhibition. And so you can imagine the scenario, you know, if your visual cortex cells just start firing away when there's, I mean, there's usually your visual cortex is supposed to fire when there's sensory input from your eyes, and you actually see something, you see that because it's being represented in sensory, visual sensory cortical firing. But if those cells start firing on their own, you will see things. And that's what LSD might be doing, is disinhibiting the cortex so that the cortex basically is running away. And people think that kind of thing could then mediate dreams, for example. Dreams are an example where you are, in fact, having sensory perceptual experiences in the absence of any input, any sensory input, and that's presumably due to the fact that whatever neural systems that generate these kinds of sensory perceptual experiences are running on their own. And when they run on their own, you get dreams, you get things like dreams, or you get things like hallucinations if you're awake. So this was a hypothesis. So this was the dominant hypothesis for a number of years. The people then continued to work on this, and what you're going to see in the next few examples of how it very quickly became, well, actually not all that quickly, but over a number of years, many years, it became apparent that this can't be true. This presynaptic hypothesis has got to be wrong. And so what I'm going to do is run through how evidence continued to accumulate to suggest that this kind of interpretation for the actions of LSD must be wrong. And that is, a number of problems started to appear concerning this presynaptic kind of hypothesis. Now, the first problem came when people actually started studying the behavioral actions of LSD in animal models. This is a hard thing to do if you think about it for a while. It's how do you study hallucinations in a rat or a cat or whatever species you want to look at? I mean, hallucinations are these sensory perceptual events. And in some extent, you can make the strong form of the argument is it's actually impossible. You can't study hallucinations in anything but humans because only humans can tell you if they're hallucinating. That can be problematic too because people tell you all kinds of strange stuff. You have no way of knowing if they're really hallucinating or they're just telling you they're hallucinating. And that's a problem with human research. But there was a whole series of experiments, most of them in cats, by a guy named Barry Jacobs of Princeton at this time. So this is getting into the 70s, early 80s now, where basically what he did was characterize the behavioral profile of a whole variety of hallucinogenic agents in cats as well as a bunch of studies in rats. And so he just looked at the behavior of the animals very carefully when they were given mescaline or LSD or psilocybin, a whole variety of hallucinogens. And what he found was that animals show very characteristic changes in their patterns of behavior under hallucinogens that are unique. That is, they're different than the patterns of behaviors you see under psychostimulants or under opiates, under amphetamine, under cocaine, under PCP. And he described what's called, sometimes it's called sort of the hallucinogenic syndrome, or sometimes it's just called the serotonin syndrome. Because you can get it by manipulating serotonergic systems in other ways. And it's quite vivid in a cat. I mean, what you get is this for array of behaviors, and they tend to be things like Animals will show excessive grooming sometimes. Cats will show funny behaviors where they'll show staring into space and then eye movements that look like eye movements following an object, but there's no object there. They'll show paw flicks and they'll flick their paws and just sort of be sitting there, you know, do this sort of stuff. So there's this whole series of behaviors like that that are tactile, grooming away at things on their body, looking at things that, appearing to look at things that aren't out there, flipping their limbs, what other kinds of things? Head shakes, shaking their head. And this cluster of behaviors is seen with hallucinogens. Now, the interpretation then is these behaviors are the overt manifestation of some sort of hallucinatory phenomena going on in their head. So it's not hard to imagine, you know, cat sitting there and sees the bird fly in front of them that's not really there, and so they follow it. Sometimes they'll grasp out at things. One can imagine tactile kinds of hallucinations where you think there's something on your paw, so you go like that. They look like that. Now, the trouble with all these studies, of course, is there's no way to know that the cat's really following the bird that's not there, or it's trying to shake off something on its paw, but that's what it looks like. And that's how it's typically interpreted. That is, these behaviors are somehow reflecting the hallucinatory phenomenon. But there's no way ever that that can be proved. At the very least, you can say hallucinogens share the ability to produce this behavioral syndrome in non-human animals. That is, they all do this and other drugs don't. So it is at least a behavioral signature of hallucinatory actions. So knowing that you can never prove it, but let's just assume that in fact this behavioral syndrome is giving you some sort of index in an non-human animal of the hallucinatory episode. Well, if you buy that assumption, then you can start studying the behavior, the hallucinatory syndrome in animals, and the neurochemistry and the electrophysiology or so on. And the first thing that was noted was the time course of the behavioral effects of a compound like LSD, and the time course of the electrophysiological effects that I already told you about don't match. That is, when you give an animal like a cat or a rat LSD, they show this behavior for a long time, just like in humans. The duration of action of LSD is quite long. So animals will show these kinds of behaviors for many, many, many hours, just like people will report hallucinations for many, many hours. But if you record from the serotonin cell bodies, electrophysiologically, you get this inhibition that I told you about. You give LSD, you get an inhibition of serotonin neurons. But that doesn't last very long. It only lasts for 30 minutes or an hour at most. Serotonin cell firing activity comes back to normal. So it's completely back to normal. But the animals are still showing, for many hours later, this hallucinatory behavior. Well, if the hallucinatory behavior is caused by LSD shutting down these cells, then the time course of the inhibition of serotonin neurons should match the time course of the behavior, and it doesn't. So that doesn't bode well for the idea that there's a direct causal relationship between the ability of LSD to shut off serotonin neurons and produce hallucinations. This is the kind of study, it's impossible to do this kind of thing in a human, of course. You have to have a human, you have to put an electrode in their brain, record from the cells, and you can't do these kinds of things. So that was one of the first problems. One of the next problems that came up is that people started studying tolerance and cross-tolerance of the behavioral syndrome, in relation to the electrophysiological syndrome. And that didn't match either. I already told you, if you give LSD repeatedly, you get marked tolerance in humans. That is, after a few administrations, you don't get much of a hallucinatory syndrome in humans. And that's also true in the animals. So this whole syndrome of flicking things off and looking at objects flying through space in front of them, if you give the drug daily, that phenomenon disappears. There's tolerance to that hallucinatory syndrome. But there isn't tolerance to the electrophysiological effects. should mention, I forgot to mention here, as we went from the early studies, Akajanian studies, showing inhibition of the cells, all of his original studies, there was no behavior. There was no behavior being measured because in those studies, all the animals were anesthetized during the recording procedures. The big advantage here is when people started looking at the behavior, is techniques were developed so that you could record the electrophysiology in an animal that was awake and moving. So you could record behavior now simultaneously with the electrophysiology. And it's only when you start doing the behavior and the electrophysiology at the same time in an awake preparation that you would ever see these mismatches, because of course in an anesthetized animal there is no behavior, and so there's no way to know whether the time course of the drug effect behaviorally is matching the time course of the electrophysiological effect. So these studies now are all in awake preparations, and that's true of the tolerance studies as well. So you give the drug a number of times, the behavioral syndrome goes away, but the electrophysiological effect, decreasing serotonin cell firing, isn't going away. It's not showing any tolerance. Day after day after day, you get as big an effect as ever for the unit activity, but the behavior is disappearing. How can the inhibition of the unit firing account for the behavior when the behavior is changing over time as a function of tolerance and the electrophysiological effects aren't? Another one had to do with cross-tolerance. I told you that there was cross-tolerance between all of these hallucinogens, between drugs like mescaline and LSD. And that's also true for this behavioral phenomenon. If you give animals repeated LSD and then give them mescaline, they're tolerant in terms of the ability of mescaline to produce this hallucinatory behavioral syndrome. But there's no cross-tolerance for the unit effect. So if you give animals LSD, and you get inhibition, first of all, you don't get inhibition to tolerance to LSD itself, and you don't get cross-tolerance to mescaline. And we know in humans, the hallucinatory effects show cross-tolerance. We know now in the animals that the behavioral effects show cross-tolerance, but the electrophysiological effects don't show cross-tolerance. It's like this ability to inhibit serotonin unit firing is not going with the behavioral syndrome. And one of the final pieces of evidence that completely killed the presynaptic hypothesis, this put it to bed. With these ones, you can come up with convoluted explanations as to how it can still work. But there were a series of lesion studies that just killed the presynaptic hypothesis. And these studies became possible when specific neurotoxins were developed that allowed people to selectively destroy the serotonin cells. So you use these are toxins like 6-hydroxydopamine, which is used to destroy dopamine neurons. This is a different one. It's 5-7-dihydroxytryptamine or something like that. You inject it down into the region of the serotonin cell bodies, and it kills the serotonin cells. Now, of course, if it kills the serotonin cells, there is no autoreceptor down here anymore because these are gone. These cells are just gone. So now you have an animal that doesn't have any serotonin neurons. What happens if you give it LSD? It shows the full hallucinatory syndrome. In fact, it shows even enhanced hallucinatory syndrome, which I'll get to in a little while, what that might be. Now, that absolutely kills the presynaptic hypothesis. Because remember, the presynaptic hypothesis was serotonin is acting at this receptor right here. You take away the cell, the receptor's not there anymore, and the animals seem to be hallucinating better under LSD, suggesting that the serotonin cells aren't at all necessary for hallucinogens to have their hallucinogenic effects, at least in these animal models. And it's not acting here now. You have to keep in mind is these serotonin receptors are still there. They're still serotonin receptors located postsynaptically on these cells in the neocortex and the hippocampus. All you've done is removed the serotonin cell itself and the autoreceptors. But there's still serotonin receptors in the brain, which is going to take you, obviously, to the next hypothesis.
because the only thing that's left are postsynaptic serotonin receptors. What else do I want to tell you about this? Is everyone clear on this so far?
It's a nice story, it all fits together, makes sense, and then it starts to shift.
So this lesion study did away with the presynaptic hypothesis.
There's absolutely no way, wow, absolutely no way to strong. See, the caveat that you still have to keep in the back of your mind is this whole series of sort of logical steps is based on an assumption, and the assumption is animals going like this is telling me something about hallucinations. This is always the assumption that's in the back of these studies. What you really want to do is take some people, knock out their serotonin neurons, give them LSD, and see if they, and ask them if they hallucinate. It might be interesting, for example, to look at people that have had a lot of use of MDMA, where you might lose serotonin terminals, and one would predict in chronic MDMA users that serotonin, that you might get effects equivalent to these kinds of lesions. On the other hand, if you take people, if you could take people that didn't have these cells, and now they didn't hallucinate LSD anymore, the hypothesis I'm going to tell you about now will be dead. That's probably not going to be tested very easily anyway. So the postsynaptic hypothesis, where does it come from? Well, first of all, now we're getting into the late 80s and 90s with the discovery of all of these different serotonin receptors, 14 different kinds of serotonin receptors. And with the discovery of all these different serotonin receptors, the development of a whole variety of serotonin receptor agonists that are very specific. Serotonin receptor agonists that are specific for serotonin, you know, 5-HT1, 5-HT2, 5-HT1A. 2A, and so on. So there's drugs that are becoming available now for the first time that allow researchers to probe the function of specific serotonin receptor populations. There's a serotonin receptor pharmacology developing, and that really is still developing. There's still not. One of the problems with the whole serotonin field is there are some drugs available that act on some serotonin receptor subtypes, but it's, you know, there's crosstalk, they're not great, they're all a little dirty. There isn't a really, really good armamentarium of pharmacological agents that allows people to study serotonergic systems. But there's quite a few. And one of the first things as these serotonin selective drugs were discovered was with the development of serotonin, specifically 5-HT2A receptor antagonist kinds of drugs, was that these kinds of drugs, 5-HT2A antagonists, antagonize the effect of LSD. So if you treat animals with a 5-HT2A receptor antagonist and now give it LSD, the animals don't show these hallucinatory behaviors. So it antagonizes this hallucinatory behavioral syndrome. And by the way, it doesn't antagonize the effects of LSD on unit firing. So in the presence of a 5-HT2A receptor antagonist, you give LSD and you record from those serotonin cells, they decrease their firing rate. So that effect is not antagonized. This is more evidence against the presynaptic hypothesis. But the animals don't show this hallucinatory syndrome, again, dissociating those two events, and suggesting that LSD has to be able to get access to a specific subtype of serotonin receptor, a 5-HT2A receptor, for it to have its effects. 5-HT2A serotonin receptors are thought to be primarily postsynaptic receptors. The presynaptic receptors are thought not to be 5-HT2-type receptors, and that fits, because it doesn't antagonize the unit effects, and the 5-HT2A antagonist shouldn't antagonize unit effects if this receptor down here is not a 5-HT2 receptor. So that's one thing. That's suggesting a postsynaptic action, because an antagonist at a receptor that's located postsynaptically antagonizes hallucinatory effects. The second kind of evidence came from these kinds of lesion studies that are demonstrated here. I told you that if you take animals that have the serotonin neurons depleted or destroyed, so serotonin is depleted up here in the cortex, that the animals actually show hypersensitivity to LSD. They show bigger, apparently, hallucinatory effects to LSD than animals that don't have a lesion. Why would that be? Well, it seems as if the reason that is a phenomenon called denervation supersensitivity. How many people know what denervation supersensitivity is? You should have had that at 3:30. I don't see a whole lot of hands going up. Okay, let me explain. Denervation supersensitivity is sort of a phenomena that you see in pretty much all neurotransmitter systems. It's been very, very well studied at the neuromuscular junction. You see it in all neurotransmitter systems. And it's sort of, I've illustrated it here. It's called denervation supersensitivity, and this is called denervation. That is, this cell is usually innervated by the serotonin neuron. If you kill the serotonin neuron, you denervate this cell. Or if you cut the peripheral nerves going to a muscle, you denervate the muscle. You denervate the muscle, and of course you're paralyzed if you do that. That's denervation. If you denervate excitable tissues, whether they be muscles or your heart muscle, or neurons, if you denervate them of their normal input, they tend to compensate. That's the supersensitivity part of it. And the way they compensate primarily is to make more receptors for whatever input is lost. So in this case, you've taken away a serotonin input here, and you remember on the previous drawing, I only had one receptor showing. Now there are two. And you can measure this receptor supersensitivity in many, many, many tissues following denervation. So if you denervate a muscle, for example, of its acetylcholine input at the neuromuscular junction, and then measure how many acetylcholine receptors are in the muscle, they increase dramatically. You just make a lot more receptors. You denervate a serotonin cell, and now you go in and measure the number of receptors on these cells, there's a lot more receptors. If you denervate the striatum of its dopamine input, you get a whole bunch more dopamine receptors on cells that have dopamine receptors. Okay, so it's denervation supersensitivity. You denervate and you get supersensitivity, and the nature of the supersensitivity is to upregulate receptors. I mean, it's a compensatory response. So you lose an input, and the postsynaptic cell is literally trying to compensate for the lost input by generating a whole bunch more receptors so that if there's at least a little bit of transmitter left around, you will still get an effect there because of this phenomenon of denervation supersensitivity. And so the concept of denervation supersensitivity is what's used to explain the enhanced hallucinatory effects of LSD in an animal that has a lesion. That is, if serotonin, or if LSD is acting at some postsynaptic receptors here, and you denervate, and you now have more postsynaptic receptors, you should shift the dose effect curve for the hallucinatory effects of LSD to the left. And that's exactly what happens. And not only that, if you relate the behavior to the chemistry, what you find is that there's a very strong correlation between the degree of receptor supersensitivity and specifically of 5-HT2A type receptor supersensitivity and the hallucinatory syndrome produced by LSD. So presumably what's happening is you're building more 5-HT2A receptors in the denervated animal. You give LSD. If LSD is acting here, LSD has a bigger effect because there's more receptors for it to act on. That's a piece of evidence to suggest that LSD is acting postsynaptically on these receptors. And what you're doing by denervating is it's a way to upregulate the receptor population. So you upregulate the receptor population, the behavioral hallucinatory syndrome goes up. The two are going together. And you go back to the presynaptic hypothesis with tolerance cross tolerance, and they don't change together. You dissociate. They're going together here. That's good for this hypothesis. You see the same thing with tolerance. You give a drug like LSD repeatedly, you get tolerance to the behavioral effects. If you give LSD repeatedly and then go in and do the chemistry and measure how many 5-HT2A receptors they are, they go down. So there's two manipulations where you manipulate the number of 5-HT2A receptors. One,
downregulate them with tolerance, and the behavior downregulates. Upregulate them with denervation supersensitivity, and the behavior upregulates. So the behavioral syndrome, the hallucinatory syndrome, is covariant with the number of 5-HT2A receptors. Third kind of evidence are purely correlational from binding studies. Or fourth kind of evidence. And in these kinds of studies, I'm showing it here. This is sort of, just look at the top panel, just ignore the bottom panel, I'm not going to talk about it. This is sort of a standard way to look at these kind of things. And I've showed you examples of this in other systems where we've talked about it. You ask a simple question. If the ability of hallucinogens is related to their ability to bind to 5-HT2A receptors, then there should be a good correlation between the ability of different drugs to bind to those receptors and the ability of different drugs to produce hallucinations. And this is the one kind of evidence where you can actually go to humans now. Because what you can ask about is, you can give different drugs, and this is human dose, and you can ask, of all of these, and every dot here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, all of these dots are a different drug. So here's LSD, here's DMA, here's DOM, and all of these are different hallucinogens. And you can ask how potent they are in humans. It's how big a dose do you need to give a human to get a certain level of hallucinatory activity. You see LSD's way up here on the dose effect curve. I told you, LSD is by far the most potent hallucinogen. And that LSD stands out by itself, and all these other guys are down here. So these drugs are relatively not potent. You need high doses to get good hallucinations. LSD is very potent. You need relatively low doses. So here you have human hallucinatory potency rather than lymph flicks and eye movements. And you relate that to the ability of these different drugs to bind specifically to 5-HT2 receptors, and this has been done specifically to 5-HT2A receptors. And what you get is a very strong correlation. The correlation, R value is 0.9. Perfect correlation is 1. So it's extremely high correlation. So if you look across a range of different hallucinatory or hallucinogenic drugs, there's a very good correlation between their ability to bind to the 5-HT2A receptor and their ability to produce real hallucinations in people, which provides strong support for all of the animal literature here that I've been showing you. It's also suggesting that this lymph flick syndrome really is telling you something about hallucinations. It's fitting together. Any questions so far? Is it all just crystal clear? You know, you have an exam on Tuesday, and this stuff's covered. Effective tolerance was just, you can think of both of these, this and this, as just being two ways where you perform some manipulation that causes receptors, 5-HT2A receptors, to downregulate, so you have fewer of them, or you have more of them. And so with tolerance, if you give LSD repeatedly, what happens is if you go in and look and measure, just assay with a binding assay, the number of 5-HT2 receptors, in animals that have been made tolerant, given repeated injections of LSD, you get a downregulation, you get fewer 5-HT2A receptors. And you get behavioral tolerance. That is, the behavioral syndrome that you get in the animal is decreased. So receptors go down, behavior goes down. And then there's the loose connection to humans, because you know with humans, when you get tolerance as well. With the other one, with the denervation supersensitivity, you do the lesion, receptor populations go up, and behavioral potency goes up. They show greater hallucinations. So as you manipulate the receptor population up or down, the behavior follows. Anything else about any of these? I actually haven't given you this hypothesis yet. I'm just giving you the data so far, but I'll state it very clearly in a couple slides. But yeah, that's going to be the difference. The previous one was that it was acting, the previous hypothesis was it was acting at this receptor, presynaptic mechanism. And I'm obviously leading up to it was acting at these guys. And that not only that, but these guys are 5-HT2A receptors specifically. And this kind of data suggests that. So if you do this kind of a correlation with other types of serotonin receptors, it doesn't work out as well. And I'll give you another piece of evidence. I mean, I told you there are 14 different kinds of serotonin receptors. So you should be asking, how do you know it's the 5-HT2A1 specifically? Because there's lots of other serotonin receptors we found postsynaptically. I haven't actually given you good evidence for that yet, but that's coming. Yeah.
You said that the effect of the antagonist was to decrease the effects of LSD.
Yeah.
But also, does it decrease also just the overall 5-HT2 cell firing? Is that what you said?
No, it doesn't have any effect on the cell firing. So if you give a 5-HT2 receptor antagonist, so you have an electrode in an animal, you can record serotonin cell firing, okay? And you give LSD, cell firing goes down, and the animal shows this hallucinatory behavior. Now you do an experiment where in your experimental group, you give them a 5-HT2 receptor antagonist and do the same experiment. Now give them LSD. What happens? Cell firing still goes down. That's not changed, but they don't hallucinate. They don't show this hallucinatory behavior anymore. Another dissociation between cell firing. Presumably, this is not. So, 5-HT2A antagonist is antagonizing the action of serotonin just the 5-HT2A receptors. There's 14 other ones there. Presumably, this is not a 5-HT2A receptor. But some other one is, and it's probably postsynaptic. Because with this, there are no presynaptic receptors. Okay, so then there's anything else then on these? The last kind of evidence, and this is the kind of pharmacology now that suggests that it's really 5-HT2A receptors and not one of the other 14 subtypes of receptors at which LSD must be acting to produce its hallucinatory effects. And these are pharmacological studies, basically looking at the differential affinity of different hallucinogens for different serotonin receptors. So I show you this correlation. I show you here that there's a very good correlation between binding the 5-HT2A receptor and the ability of drugs to produce hallucinations. But there are 14 other kinds of receptors. So you need to do a lot more pharmacology to convince yourself that it's really the 2A subtype of the 14 that's critical. And the pharmacology is very complex because there's so many bloody serotonin receptors. This is sort of not experimental kind of evidence so much as it is logical. What you do is take this kind of tack. You take a whole bunch of hallucinogens, mescaline, LSD, DOM, DMT, psilocybin, and so on. And you ask, well, for all these different drugs, they all have different spectrum of activities. They influence. None of these drugs, like LSD is not a clean drug. LSD has actions on all kinds of serotonin receptors. So LSD, for example, if you look for its affinity, its ability to bind to different serotonin receptors, LSD is promiscuous. LSD binds to 5-HT type 1, 2, 5, 7, 6, and 7 types. So it binds to a whole bunch of different serotonin receptors. The question is, which receptors is it binding? Does it bind to produce its hallucinatory effects? It binds to many different kinds. It has many different effects. It has effects on smooth muscle contractions. It has effects on those autoreceptors. It has lots of different effects unrelated to its hallucinatory effects. The key question here is, which effect is related to its hallucinatory effects? So LSD is very promiscuous. It binds to all kinds of serotonin receptors. So that doesn't tell you anything. But now you start to look at other hallucinogens. So if you look at something like mescaline, you see mescaline, which is a hallucinogen, which shows cross-tolerance LSD, doesn't bind to the 1, 5, or 7 family. Well, if LSD and mescaline are sharing common actions, which everything suggests they are, then you can eliminate the 1, the 5, and the 7 families, which leaves you with the 6 and the 2. And you run through that logic with all the different hallucinogens, and what you find is although different hallucinogens have different spectrums of actions across different serotonin receptor subtypes, the one thing that they all share in common is the ability to bind to this 5-HT2 family of receptors. So one may bind to the 1, but not the 3, another one the 3 and not the 1, and so on, so on, and so on. But you run through 20 drugs, the one thing they end up that share hallucinatory actions but don't share other actions, the one thing you come up with is they share an affinity for the 5-HT2 family. And now it gets a little dicey in terms of the logic, in terms of narrowing it down to 5-HT2A receptors. But the logic goes, for example, that 5-HT2A receptors are the type of two receptors that show the greatest expression in regions like the neocortex. And now we go back to the idea that hallucinogens have to be acting in the neocortex to produce hallucinatory effects. You can't make up pictures of the tigers in the mind without your cortex. And most of these other subtypes aren't found highly expressed in the neocortex. It's the 2A type of two receptors, not the 2B or the 2C or the 2D that are highly expressed in the neocortex. That's one. And then the other line of evidence, of course, is that it's the 5-HT2A antagonist that antagonizes LSD's actions. So you put those kind of pharmacology together, and what you end up with is the prevailing hypothesis. This is now the prevailing hypothesis of how hallucinogens work, is what they're doing is acting as 5-HT2A receptor agonists. They're acting at 5-HT2A serotonin receptors, and they're mimicking the action of serotonin at those receptors. They're acting as agonists. And so this is what people now think all of the hallucinogens are doing to produce their hallucinatory effects. They're doing other things to produce their other effects, but this is what they're doing to produce their hallucinatory effects. But one lesson you should also take away here, of course, is we've ran through some data that was pretty convincing for hypothesis at that time. What kind of data is going to come up over the next 10 years, and will this kind of hypothesis be actual? But make the hypothesis, the postsynaptic hypothesis, very clear now. It's the idea that you have postsynaptic receptors up here in the neocortex, presumably. LSD is binding to that receptor, presumably because of its structural similarity to serotonin. The reason it binds to a serotonin receptor is, remember, it's structurally similar to serotonin itself. And it's not acting as an antagonist there, it's acting as an agonist and mimicking the action of serotonin. Why do you think it's acting as an agonist instead of an antagonist? And the main kind of evidence there is that an antagonist antagonizes its actions, which is actually isn't all that strong evidence. Let's back up a little bit. This is an example of differentiating whether a compound is an agonist or an antagonist in producing these kinds of effects can be pretty tricky. So the evidence suggested that LSD is binding to a 5-HT2A receptor and it is producing its hallucinatory effects from binding to that receptor, but is it mimicking the action of serotonin at this receptor or is it antagonizing the action of serotonin at this receptor? It's from what I've told you, it's actually hard to tell. One reason people think that it's acting as an agonist, and probably one of the strongest reasons is that 5-HT2 receptor antagonists are not hallucinatory. So that suggests that it's an agonist. Now, there were a couple. Okay, there are two other things I wanted to say. One of them is again, just to stress this caveat that a lot of this sort of logic that's built up in terms of how hallucinogens act is based on this assumption
that animals going like this and showing eye movements are really having hallucinations. And that's very, I mean, that's impossible to prove. The evidence is all consistent with it, so it's reasonable, but that's pretty hard to prove. To really, really test the hypothesis, what you want to be able to do, and these studies have never been done, is take someone, like one of you guys, give you LSD, get you hallucinating, and then do the pharmacology. Give you a 5-HT2A receptor antagonist. Give you a 5-HT1 receptor, and do the pharmacology, and see whether or not you can, in fact, do, simple question, do 5-HT2A antagonists prevent hallucinations in real people? Never been done. Can't do it. Not allowed.
That probably will never be answered unless some of the pharmacologists in some labs and places have probably actually done the experiment themselves, but they can't publish it. The other thing I should mention here is sort of a mystery in this field, is what the endogenous ligand is at this 5-HT2A receptor. It's called the serotonin receptor. It's a 5-HT2A receptor. But in actual fact, serotonin has very low affinity for that receptor. It's, if I wrote it down. Yeah. So serotonin, if you look at the affinity of serotonin for the 5-HT2A receptor, it's in the micromolar range. Just to give you a comparison, at the 5-HT2-1 receptor, those types of receptors, serotonin has nanomolar affinity, okay, 1,000-fold greater affinity. So serotonin itself is actually not a very good ligand at the 5-HT2A receptor. These hallucinogens are better ligands than serotonin, which has led people to raise the possibility that maybe serotonin is not the endogenous ligand at the 5-HT2A receptor. Maybe it's not really a serotonin receptor at all. Serotonin has affinity for it, but not very good affinity, which raises the possibility that in your brain some places and this yet undiscovered endogenous ligand for the 5-HT2 receptor, that is your brain's own LSD. And it just simply hasn't been discovered yet. And that's, no one knows if that might be the case. But that is a mystery. I mean, why does serotonin have such low affinity for this receptor?
If, like, someone reported to an emergency room with a bad acid trip, would they give them a compound and pull them out of it?
No.
They couldn't do anything else. In that setting, would they try?
Put them in a safe place, talk to them nicely. It'll wear off. It's not that dangerous.
Would that be a setting where they could try the serotonin antagonist?
These are not, these compounds have lots of other effects. They're not the kind of things that you would do to antagonize a bad trip. Okay, exam on Tuesday. Don't forget.